Hey, everybody, you have landed on The Substance. I'm your host, Philip Marinello. As some of you may know, if you're a regular listener, we are back to doing weekly drops here. We are currently in the process of kind of regrouping, retooling kind of our internal processes. As some of you know, Editor Dave has gone back to grad school and is no longer going to be with us. So we are kind of, he was very important. So now I am kind of trying to learn how to do the editing, or hey, if anybody has a good line on an editor, would maybe be interested in that. But yeah, we are kind of retooling some things here at The Substance. So for the next few weeks, we are going to be re-releasing classic episodes. And this week is a real surprise one. So if you're new to The Substance, we're a podcast seeking to aim at goodness, truth, and beauty. And we like having conversations with intelligent, interesting, compassionate, caring people, talented folks about a variety of topics. This week's episode that we are re-releasing, man, this was such a surprise for me. And I think for Trevor as well, back when we were doing this. So this is episode 89 with Dr. Felicia Wu Song. This was, again, almost immediately a very high numbered episode for us. Ton of downloads. And what was so shocking for us is that this whole conversation is about the dangers of technology and their negative effects on us. And Dr. Song doesn't have a traditional social media platform. So we were like, well, we're not going to get retweeted. We're not going to get shared on an Instagram feed or an Instagram story. So whenever we get little bumps from our guests, like we have our core audience and we love you guys very, very much. But yeah, we always get nice little bumps from our guests. So we're like, well, I wonder how that's going to work for this. Like I emailed it over to our friends over at IVP who are great. But then I sent it over to Dr. Song. And because she is so purposeful about her social media presence, it's very powerful. She's got a newsletter and the people who are on it are big fans of hers. And we got an enormous bump on this episode. So this was a great conversation. I feel like in this technology saturated world we're living in, I feel like this type of conversation is always going to be important. It's not technology bad. It's just that we need to be aware and purposeful of how we use it as a tool so that we don't dehumanize ourselves and destroy communities and our brains and our minds and all sorts of things like that. So this was a wonderful conversation. And it's still, whenever I think about just the response to that episode, I always smile. And of course, we want to say if The Substance is something you enjoy and you haven't done it yet, while you're listening to this episode, open up, whether it's on Spotify or Apple Music or what have you. If you hit that 5-star button, maybe write a couple sentence review of why you like the show. It always helps us reach a new audience and we appreciate it greatly. So now here is our conversation with Dr. Song.
You've landed on The Substance, a podcast aimed at being biblical, thoughtful, and human. Join us each week as we engage the culture without the culture war. I'm your host, Vincent Edwards, joined here by my friends and co-hosts, my boys, my homies, Philip Marinello.
Hey, everybody.
And Trevor Aiken.
What's going on?
How y'all doing tonight? How y'all feeling?
What's up? All right.
I'm feeling better now. I was like, oh man, like I was getting ready for this tonight. I was like, I feel like garbage, but last 20 minutes or so,
Sometimes it's just a day. I got a nice little
pep, so I'm ready.
Maybe awesome. Maybe someone's coming listening here and it's been a day for them. And if so, you're welcome here. Come hang out with
Absolutely.
Us.
So if you are a returning guest, we want to say welcome back. If you're a new guest, we want to say welcome. The Substance is a Christian variety show, and every week we talk for about an hour about something or a number of things in Christianity, culture, and the arts. At the end, we share some shout-outs of things we or our guests have been finding enjoyable or edifying, so we welcome you to the show. As you've clicked on this episode, we have on today a very special guest, Dr. Felicia Wu Song. She is a professor of sociology at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California, and interim chair of the sociology and anthropology department. She is a writer, a speaker, mother of two, and last but not least, she is an author, including her most recent book, just released November 2021 with IVP, called Restless Devices: Recovering Personhood, Presence, and Place in the Digital Age. Welcome, Felicia, to the show.
Thank you. It's so great to be with you all.
That's quite a resume. What did you say? She was chair of anthropology, what?
Sociology and anthropology department.
Man. That's giving us like a nice little bump of prestige right there. I like it.
Yeah, it's interim. It's okay. I was chair before. I'm filling in for a colleague right now. But yes.
Well, we're very happy to have you, Felicia.
Thanks.
Absolutely.
Thanks. It's really great to be with you guys.
I've basically been going through this particular book, Restless Devices, with my pastor as we just kind of do some discipleship. So I'm super geeked to have you on. And honestly, I just wanted to start with just asking you about how you came to faith and what led you to study the particular subject of the digital age and technology.
So I grew up in a Christian home. My parents immigrated from Taiwan, and when they came to the United States, they converted to Christianity. So by the time I was born, I was going with them to what I've recently learned. There's a word for this. It's called a Chinese Baptist church. So it's an ethnic church. It was all Chinese immigrants. And theologically, it was basically Baptist, even though it didn't have a denominational affiliation. And so I grew up in that and, you know, became a Christian within that context. Really wasn't someone that was particularly curious, quite frankly, as a young person. I just kind of followed what was told to me and it all kind of made sense. And when I went off to college, I joined InterVarsity, Christian Fellowship, which was super great. Nice. I grew so much and learned so much about the relationships that can be built within Christian fellowship, like genuine Christian fellowship. Mm-hmm. And it was during college that I actually, through a conversation with a friend, learned that one could actually bring one's faith into the classroom. That is, that there could be a relationship between one's faith and what one thinks about the mind, right? The intellectual life. And this was something that was completely foreign to me beforehand. Like it was just, I had my personal pious faith over here, my classes and thinking about career over there, nothing to do with each other, right? So when I had this conversation with this friend, it was just, was like a light bulb just like burst in my head, you know, of just like, really? I could start thinking about my classes from a Christian perspective and not just simply feel like the class, because I went to a secular school, is just a threat or was going to, you know, erode my faith. It was going to threaten me, right? Like I was like, whoa, I can actually start thinking about this. And so by the time I left college, I was like a total late bloomer because my brain was racing then. I was like needing to catch up, you know, because I hadn't been thinking at all from a faith perspective. And so after college, I had a job teaching at a private school. I was a history teacher because I studied history as an undergrad. And while I was there, and this is really going to date me because you guys are like, y'all are young guys, man. It was the first year that at this private school, they brought email to the students. Okay. So we're in the mid 90s. And it was fascinating to me because we spent a lot of time talking in this private school about relationships and community. And then we brought email and we had no conversation about how email was actually going to impact all the ways that we related to each other as students, as teachers, as dorm parents, and so forth. And so that got me thinking. That struck me as just being kind of strange. I was like, shouldn't we be talking about this? Shouldn't we be intentional about wondering, like, how is email going to change things for us here? And so I started wondering about that. I stumbled upon Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death.
Classic.
And I was like, wow, there's people that write about media, think about this stuff. And I also ended up going to LaBrie Fellowship, if you're familiar with that, up in Southborough, Massachusetts for a term, and was just in such a supportive environment to have those questions be cultivated, right? And so it became clearer during that time that I needed to go to grad school, and I wanted to study more about how media and technology has been impacting through American history, right? Our relationships, our sense of community, our experience of identity. And I was also super interested in why it was that in American society, we don't talk about this stuff. Like, we just kind of take the media, we take the technology, we use it, we love it, we embrace it, but we don't really have like really substantive conversations about it. Until I would say until kind of recently, you know, we've kind of started having more genuine conversations about it between each other. That's kind of my journey.
You mentioned Postman. I was going to ask, were there any things that you read in college or around that time that were kind of spurring things on, or is this just natural curiosity? Like, were there other moments or resources or books that you read that kind of got you thinking, or was it just kind of the curiosity of you, like your observation of this is having an effect and are we talking about this? Like, how did that kind of go for you?
Yeah. I mean, it really was, it wasn't anything I had really thought about during college. And I think what I was interested in college was how it is that we come to believe and think what we think. So as a history major, I was mainly interested in intellectual history or cultural history, the history of ideas. I took a 20th century intellectual history class, and that was absolutely fascinating to me. I read a book, and this doesn't have to do with media, but this was one of my most formative books. I read George Marsden's book on fundamentalism, and that completely blew my mind. Because it gave me context for understanding my own journey, what church I had grown up. Like, I grew up in a Chinese church. I thought it was only just this group of Chinese immigrants. But when I read Marsden's Fundamentalism, I realized, wow, this theology that I grew up with, the culture, the Christian culture I grew up with, is actually rooted in this, you know, 20th century experience, right? That these Americans had experienced, had nothing to do with the culture that I grew up in, right? And and so that really set the stage for me for thinking about, you know, how do we come to, again, believe what we believe, assume that the world, the reality is the way that it is. And I think it was really at that time when I was teaching at that private school that I became interested in how media and technology do that. It also helped that U2 happened to be having their famous tour, it was called like Even Better Than the Real Thing or Achtung Baby. It was back then. And they had this great tour that was also interrogating this question of reality and how media creates a simulation of reality that we become more interested in. So there are a couple different things there.
As you're studying these things about technology and our acceptance of it, is America as a culture, do you have any sense of, are we more tending to accept and embrace and just be like, oh yeah, cool, new technology, yeah, whatever. That obviously is morally good. Obviously there's positive value if it's a new technology versus other cultures.
Yeah.
And why?
So I haven't done a lot of work studying, other cultures and other societies, but I think there definitely is a history of what's called technological utopianism that is a part of the American imagination.
Yeah. Right?
And that is rooted in our own kind of origin story in this country, right?
Yeah.
Like, hey, we're the new experiment. We're the ones that don't have the baggage that those old country, you know, European countries had, right? Yes. Sure, London had their industrial revolution and they polluted the Thames. It's all smoggy over there. But look at what we have over here in America, right? We have all these natural resources. We're the ones that can kind of like break the code. We can figure out, right, how to bring human progress through technology without all the downsides, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just part of that enlightenment imagination of we use reason, we use science, we could figure this out, right? Yeah. And we will bring humanity to a better place.
Wow. Yeah. That exceptionalism of like, yes, we're not going to hit the pratfalls. Like, that's not going to be us.
Exactly. Right. Look at all those folks. They had those religious wars. We're not going to have those religious wars. We're not going to kill each other over these things. We're beyond that.
Yeah.
Because we're America. We've got reason. We've got enlightenment. We've got science. We've got democracy. We can do this. And I think the technology, you know, and certainly a lot of the, you know, the time that the country was really coming into its own was a time of incredible technological progress. I mean, there's like amazing things were happening, right? Mm-hmm. The steam technology, railroad technology, the telegraph, all of this was like mind blowing. So it's understandable, but it's definitely wrapped up, you know, in our American identity, sense of identity, and exceptionalism, as you said.
Yeah. As a person of faith, how have you seen technology or the digital age affect our practice of ecclesiology?
Whoa. Okay. So I tend to think that in the United States, we imagine our technologies as individualized experiences, right? We think of it within the individualistic imagination. Hmm. And to that extent, when I think about ecclesiology and I think about how we imagine church, mm-hmm, and participation in church, the technologies, especially the media and communication technologies that we've had in the 20th century, thinking about radio, television, now the internet, mm-hmm, their relationship with the church, it has often reinforced and shaped a fairly individualistic model in people's, mm-hmm, minds of what participation in church looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the media itself is merely a tool to transport a message that is individualistic, right? Very, mm-hmm, often in the church, a individualistic message of salvation, rather, mm-hmm, than one about a participation within a community, mm-hmm, within a church life that is fundamentally relational, mm-hmm, and much larger than the individual experience. I don't know if that gets at what you're striving at.
Wow. But
that's where my mind goes to first. Happy to go where you want to go, Vince.
If I could ask Vince a follow-up to that. I've been talking with some friends recently about the metaverse and church, mm-hmm, and I think it's a lot of hype right now, but, mm-hmm, you've got some people on one side saying, well, there's a problem when you take community and make it virtual, mm-hmm, versus actually being with your neighbors.
Yeah.
But then there's this counter argument of, well, what about the persecuted? What about the shut-ins? What about, you know, all these things? So I just wonder, mm-hmm, what your thoughts are on the church in metaverse world, and what could be the potential dangers there?
Yeah.
Or benefits.
Yeah. I think that conversation about the metaverse church is the same conversation as pandemic church, which is the same conversation as the virtual church that folks were talking about when SimCity started, you know, like back in the day. Like, virtual church has been a very alluring idea, I think, for a couple decades now. And it's been interesting to actually be going through this pandemic, you know, for going on 2 years now, where, right? We've all kind of just been forced into a situation where we're like, okay, we're trying to make this work. And there's this digital resource here, which in many ways is a true gift. You know, I mean, it's amazing that we can, mm-hmm, still gather in certain ways. For me, what's more interesting, rather than kind of thinking about, well, what would the virtual church look like, is actually asking the question, well, what makes embodied church necessary? Mm. What is it about the quote-unquote old-fashioned way of doing things, right? Like gathering people together. What was in that practice that made being together actually essential?
Mm-hmm.
And what makes me ask this is because, you know, my students now are saying, hey, I don't really see why I need to go back to the local church. There's all these great YouTube programs, YouTube worship services I can go to, right? Great preaching, great podcasts like this one I can listen to, right? Like, why do I need to go to church?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a real question.
A lot of people don't engage that. They just like tweet angrily, like, you're wrong. And not really address like the human things that are at the heart of that question.
Yeah.
Yes, right. Because for many of them, they go to church, they sit, they watch.
Yeah.
They sing.
They consume. They're individualistic consumers. They're like, why can't I consume individualistically online? Yes. Like, what's the difference?
So like, we've already made church virtual just in a seat with walls.
Yes, exactly. And so for me, the question is like, whoa, we've actually hit this really interesting point in our church, local church life, where we actually have to ask this question. What are we doing on Sunday mornings that actually draws people here, right? Where they're like, oh, I don't need to just like that, where they would feel loss, right? If they were just watching it on YouTube, like, what are we doing in person?
Not even just to draw people in to like increase the size, but like to be faithful.
No, no, exactly.
I feel like theology of place keeps coming up just because that's a big issue now that we face. Partially because of digital ubiquity, partially because of COVID, partially because of like the identity crisis that has been brewing, like in especially like the evangelical type church where people are like, well, I believe these things, but like a lot of the other things with the packaging of these churches, I don't really feel like fit me anymore. And like, I'm not going to go to like a universalist church. So what do I even do? Like, if I can't find a church who's like, whose people I want to associate with, like, what do I even do?
I've been hearing about these, this new church movement. I can't remember what it's called, but it's these churches that eat together. Not just that they do worship service and then they have lunch together, you know, in the basement, not that kind of thing. But like church is actually eating together.
Interesting.
Like, that's church.
Like their liturgy is.
Yeah, yeah. A right. meal. Like, yes. And I find that that's really interesting right? Yeah. Because it builds in exactly these issues of embodiment, of place, of even communion in a like visceral way, right? Like we are eating together.
Sure, right.
And I just find that model to be really, I don't know, it just spurs my imagination, you know, in kind of fun ways to think like, what could we be doing? And I totally agree. It's not about filling the pews, right? It's just like, what makes it worthwhile for anyone to get up and go and hang out with these people? And what commitments are we really trying to live into by being a community that would be genuinely invitational that way, where someone would be like, oh, I want to go on Sunday because it's actually refreshing, right?
Yeah.
It's like genuinely refreshing after everything I've been through these 6 days, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I really want to just go to be completely who I am and be welcomed there.
Yeah.
It's like Acts, you know, where it talks about they all held the community there in high respect. And it was like, there was so many, there was a ton of people joining, but there was also the people who didn't dare join, even though they had that high respect and saw it because they knew, oh, well, that's a commitment that I'm just,
things will be required. If I join, like, I mean, essentially, like, there's accountability. Like, I have to, my life will have requirements on it.
But it wasn't like, oh, they stayed away because, like, those folks are whack over there and they're mean to each other. You know, like that's not what it says.
There's a high standard.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear, Felicia, before we get into any of the specific points of the book, what became the book? Something you were already researching and writing? And did IVP reach out to you?
Yeah. You know, the book's, quite frankly, it's been on my mind for a long time. and there's ways in which, if I had my druthers, this book would have come out 3 years earlier, but life is life. But it's just been a burden on my heart, really, to be bringing the sociology and the theology together, I just felt like there's a combination, like there's lots of good philosophies of technology, theologies of technology books that are out there.
Sure.
Great folks talking about that stuff. But I just felt like there's something about sociology that diagnoses the problem that we're living in that is unique and helpful, that would be just practical for people's lives to have. And pairing that with a theologically informed prescription, that there's something about that combination that I've just been wanting to write on since I started grad school, right? And in a lot of ways, that's why I got into what I, you know, the career that I have now, is to really try to equip people with helpful tools, ways of imagining that might be different from kind of what we tend to get in our day to day, that would bring some kind of hope. Because I think I've just been in too many conversations with all sorts of people who are just like, I don't know how to stop this thing. Mm-hmm. My life is so deep, so driven by the technological demands. I can't stop. I don't know how to get out of this. There's a deep kind of despair, right, that I've borne witness to over and over again, whether it's about themselves or about their kids, their spouse, whatever it is. It just felt like, man, we got to bring this conversation into the church, you know? And so in many ways, the book is written with the hopes that church leaders would find it helpful.
Mm-hmm. But I like how you kind of sell that in the subtitle too, like recovering personhood, presence in place. Like we all know subconsciously, if not clearly, that there's something that we've kind of lost or are losing. And I like how you kind of put that out front there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, IVP was helpful with that one. So yeah, they helped me on the cover and the title. So props to them for all of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Another incredible cover. Shout out to the cover designer. I always forget his name, but I tag him. IVP is always crushing it with those book covers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I read in the first chapter that you talk about how we presume that technology's nature is neutral or virtually neutral. Like it's just a tool that people use. And if it has a negative effect, then, you know, that means somebody's using it improperly. Mm-hmm. Discuss that with us about how that can be true in some sense, but it's also a misunderstanding of technology's nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think it's much more helpful and productive to think of technologies as artifacts of society.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we situate it that way, technology is an artifact of society, then we can grab onto the fact that, hey, if it's an artifact, that means someone built it, someone created it. And that someone is a human being with particular values, a particular vision of what it means to be human, of what the good life is, that they intentionally or unintentionally designed into that product, that artifact, right? Whether they knew it or not, they embedded just these assumptions,
these values,
about what would make life better for someone. And that if we understand that, then we need to ask, okay, well, so who are the producers? So who are the designers? Who are the engineers? What assumptions are they bringing to the table when they created this platform, this device? And then for us as users, I think it's super important to, again, recognize how we are all embedded in a society that finds meaning through, again, visions of the good life, visions of what it means to be human. We use our technologies to build meaning, to be productive, to gain significance, whatever it might be.
That's a big selling point. That's how we justify them to ourselves most often.
Right. And so if we're going to think about, well, what's the effect of technology? I think it's much more productive to actually take into account all these other facets, not just the individual user who may be using it for good or for ill, right? Certainly that may be the case, but that there are all these other factors in the production, in the ways that even apart from the engineer, you have these corporations, you know, whether it's Facebook or Google, right, that have their goals. They have goals and they have ends mm-hmm. that they're trying to meet that are then interfacing with our, you know, in this society, you know, the American imagination, the American mm-hmm. cultural values that are all at play when we're using our devices.
Man, that's solid.
One of the things that stuck out to me, I was listening to the audiobook and taking notes on my phone, very technological experience with my issue of the book, but I liked how you talked about the difference between technology being alluring to various aspects and desires of our humanity versus satisfying. And I found that a very helpful paradigm because it's easy, and I don't think entirely wrong, to go, okay, like, I need a minute of rest. Like, I want to blow off steam, or I'm going to watch a funny video, or mm-hmm. I'm going to go check my favorite Twitter feed to see if there's anything interesting or thought-provoking or funny or whatever. But talk to us about the dichotomy of alluring versus mm-hmm. satisfying.
So I think the alluring part of our devices is something that the corporations and businesses that are promoting these devices and services are all about. This is what they specialize in. They have experts and researchers that understand the psychology. They understand what's going on in our brains. They understand what colors the buttons need to be so that we're going to be like, ooh, I want to press that blue button or that red button, right? Mm-hmm. And so they've created these incredibly brilliant platforms that understand these sorts of base appetites and desires that we have as human beings. And how, as one scholar puts it, you know, social media is like chips, you know, like we just want to eat the chips just because, you know, we're mm-hmm. feeling kind of munchy. You know? Yeah. We don't even know why we're eating it. We're just like, I want a little munchy. Yeah. We're not even hungry, really. Yeah, sure. Right. We're just like pounding the chips.
Just need to doom scroll right now.
That's right.
This is, yep. This is nice enough. So I'm here.
Yeah. Yeah.
The bag is here.
That's right. Right. And so the devices and the services are built to meet those appetites and those desires. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, we all, we've all had that experience where we spend a whole night, you know, just like doing whatever it is that we do, you know, whether it's your gaming or you're shopping for shoes or you're doom scrolling, like whatever your thing is, right? Mm-hmm. And then after those 2 hours, you're like, I what was I just doing? You know, like, why did I just spend those 2 hours doing that? I do not know.
Yeah, that reminds me of the time of Vine when it's like, it's literally just a 6 second video. Yeah. And well, I catch myself just like
10 seconds. Oh yeah.
On 6 second videos. That broke me. It was so convicting. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but it just reminds me of that phenomenon of just being able to watch something and it's less than a minute. It's literally less than a minute, and it's designed that way.
You're like, yeah, it's just a minute.
Right, not exactly. Thinking,
this is 2.5 hours of 1 minute, but I'm just taking a minute and a minute.
Yeah. And you convince yourself that it's just, I'm just going to watch a couple of videos and they're 6 seconds. So it's not going to take me much time to watch a few videos. Mm-hmm. And then next thing you know, it's evening. And it's like, what have I been doing all day?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's where, like, for me, and I don't know exactly if this is a dichotomy you were thinking of, but I think about how we kind of have like our lesser selves and our better selves. You know,
sure.
And I think of like the lesser self is the self that's going to just like eat that whole bag of Doritos or spend those 2 hours, you know, scrolling on whatever it is. And the better self is the one that says, wait a second. You know, when I look back in my life, I don't want to look and see a whole, you know, trail of Friday nights that were just demolished by eating chips and watching videos that really didn't matter in the end, right? Mm-hmm. Like when I look back in my life, I want to see some Friday nights that were actually like had a good time spending it with my friends, or I was creating music, or, you know, like I was doing something that was meaningful.
Yeah, the personhood, yeah. Presence in place, like that you were engaging your true self.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think the thing about the digital that worries me is that it so easily mutes us down to our lesser selves, right? Like it fills us. It fills that lesser self appetite so easily because it's easy. Mm-hmm. And so often the things that are satisfying take work, you know? I mean, and work might even just look like going over to that side of the room and picking up the guitar and actually playing it, right? Yeah. Instead of just watching videos, which is so much easier.
Yeah.
Like the margin is actually very small, like the work. But I think we all know when we do devote ourselves to the work, quote unquote, of creating something, of actually knocking on someone's door and be like, hey, you want to go get coffee? You know, like instead of just texting, right? Let's go do something together. That kind of work leads to something that's deeply satisfying in a way that we can easily forget. You know, like we can forget that it's there.
I think that's such a good paradigm that you're laying out right there between like the baser self, the more appetite driven self versus the higher value, the pursuit of transcendence, whether that's friendship and other great things. And this word that you've landed on here of work kind of being the differentiator, not that it has to be even that much and not that it's not fun, but the energy there. And earlier you were mentioning that these artifacts, these technological artifacts that people create are not created in a vacuum, but as part of a system. And what I'm thinking about is how 40 years ago, techno-utopianism, like you're talking about, it was like everybody's going to have a 20-hour work week and all this stuff. But it seems like instead, the technology is actually used, it's like a juicer, like it's extracting us just better and better and better. And so at the end of the day, I feel extracted, you know, by this system. And so then when I think about that work to read a book, to play the guitar, to pick it up, right. I feel like I've already been so extracted elsewhere, like through just even all of my my normal life, putting bread on the table, whatever. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that it was physical labor necessarily. I'm not physically tired, but I just feel spiritually, emotionally, mentally extracted. And so this quick distraction, this scroll, meets with the resources I feel like I had. So can you talk about like the system and then also maybe some hope for people who, how do you get past that? Like where you feel like the systems are continuing to extract you. So you feel like you have no resources, no hope to get to that higher level, like you were talking about. How do you break that cycle?
Yeah. Ooh. I love that word that you've landed on, extraction. I mean, that's a powerful word. I think it is helpful, even if it is depressing, to realize that it actually is an entire system. It's not just because you're weak and you don't have what it takes. It's not just because your boss is demanding. It's not just because this device is around. It is an entire system of corporations, of internet service providers, of a culture of productivity, right? That is all just kind of pressing in to result in exactly what you're saying, right? We get to the end of the day and we've got nothing left. We're just done. And so I do think it's helpful and empowering to realize, oh, I'm actually up against this big thing. And then to start thinking, okay, well, how can I push back against this? How can I square out, box out some kind of sacred space, sacred time that is going to be a source of life for me, that will give me genuine rest after a day like this, but also reignite my imagination so that I can start to re-see what I am trying to do when I'm putting bread on the table or spending time with my kids or doing whatever, you know, going to school, right? Re-see it in such a way that it's not just, I call it a tyranny, right? A tyranny of the digital, where you're just being kind of whipped and you know, kind of driven. Like I'm just driven by my calendar. I'm driven by these alarms that are going off telling me I got to go to my next thing.
God forbid your notifications.
God forbid your notifications. Exactly. I just think, you know, this is where being a person of faith, being someone who has resources within the Christian heritage is actually super exciting because Christianity is a faith that has a theology and has a whole history of spiritual disciplines and practices that is all about this. It's like we have a theology of rest. We have a theology of embodiment. We have all these practices that are about stillness and solitude and silence that are meant to recenter you, that we just need to learn more about and read more about and kind of hang out with the desert fathers and desert mothers and be like, what were they doing in the desert, you know, praying and being in solitude? What were those hermits actually trying to do? I just think there's a lot of exciting resources there for us to start learning from.
Yeah. And just to follow that question up, because I think that was really good, at least personally in my experience and in conversations that I've had with others, you know, you say, hey, there's a different way and we can disconnect, like you said, center. And I think one word that you used in the book was abide. Mm-hmm. And so there's an ability to do that. There's a theology for that for the believer. But then often what's met with that when you say, hey, you can do this and it's okay. And it will take time and it'll take work, but you can. Immediately what comes to mind is either the feeling of frustration towards my devices and towards even the practice of getting away from my devices, or fear, because it's like, well, this is how I'm connected to the world. And I don't know how to be connected to the world any other way. If I'm not on my phone, if I don't have some social media, if I'm not texting, if I'm not emailing, if I don't have something, then I'm no longer connected. And so that draws up either frustration or fear. So what would you encourage that person who has that desire to want to have that balance of being able to engage with technology and the digital, but also have a balance of just being, you know, abiding with the Lord, or even if it's just being peaceful on the inside? How would you encourage that person as they encounter that fear or that frustration?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing I would say to that person is the fear is for real, right? Like, that's legitimate. Yeah. You know, we live in a situation where so much of our social lives, our work lives, our family lives are enmeshed in the digital, right? So that fear of like, well, what would it mean to step away from that? Because that would threaten the social and the work and the family. Like, that's a for real thing, you know. So that's a legitimate fear, and the frustration is also legitimate, right? Like, that's all very understandable reaction. I would also then encourage that person to think about what very small micro adjustments you can start taking that are actually experiments. And this is what I like to do with my students, who totally are frustrated and afraid, right? When we talk about these things, I say, hey, let's just try a few things. Of course, they're my students, so I give them assignments, so I'm coercing them to do these experiments, right? But these experiments are just, it's sort of like, hey, just try this thing, you know? And in my class, there's this point in the semester that everyone knows when it's happening. It's that, and I could see it in my students' eyes. You know, it's like too many papers, too many extracurriculars, not enough sleep. Everyone's just kind of like, and like the end of the semester is too far away to start hoping, right? Mm-hmm. And everyone's just like, I cannot. I say, hey, you know what we're going to do? We're going to take 15 minutes today. And then I happen to live and work at a place that's chronically beautiful and perfect in weather. So we can do this.
California.
I'm embarrassed to admit that. Where I can say to them, hey, you know, we're going to not do class for 15 minutes. You're going to go out. You're going to find a patch of grass. You're going to go find a tree. You're going to find a bush to lay under, whatever it is, right? Whatever it is, you can take 15 minutes. I just want you, and I do send them out with a couple prompts, you know, like, what is it that's like totally distracting me? What's all the noise that's filling me now? What do I wish I could be doing? You know, write it down, 15 minutes. They come back and it's like that look in their eye is like gone for those 15 minutes, after those 15 minutes. And there's a lot of sadness when they come back, actually, because there's, you know, they've thought about things that they haven't thought about because they've been on the go, you know?
It's real.
But what I tell them is, hey, you just moved from one place to another in 15 minutes. That was just 15 minutes. I'm not asking you for 2 hours a day, you know, which is what we often think. We think like, I got to go run 5 miles and like detox and put my phone away for a weekend. It's like, no. Like, just stop for 15 minutes, 10 minutes, maybe even, you know, for some of us, maybe we live lives where it's five, you know, where it's just like, I'm just going to take 5 minutes. I'm going to put the phone away. I'm just going to be quiet for 5 minutes. And we experiment, we find out. Like, what happens during that time? Maybe it's when we're driving and we're like in that in middle commute time, right? We're like, I'm just going to turn off the music, turn off this awesome podcast, and I'm just going to be quiet.
I don't do that often enough, but it's, you feel that when you like, I'm always I listen to music, but I'm always cranking podcasts or audiobooks, but every now and then. Like, I'm saying, okay, I'm going to take a second. I'm going to take a minute or two.
Yeah.
Turn it off. Right. And it's like, you do, it doesn't take long. Like, we are so enmeshed, even when we're trying to be like resourceful in how we use it. We're so enmeshed. Like, you feel that in like a couple of minutes of just, nothing blaring at your face out of the speakers. You just go, like, you just feel a little refreshed.
And you feel like you're doing something noble as well, because it's like if you're listening to a podcast or listening to a book, especially if it's informative, it's like, no, this is not a bad thing, because I'm learning and I'm, you know, engaging with information. I'm becoming, you know, smarter in this moment from, you know, work to home. So it's, you know, it's almost seen as an intrinsic good. And again, it's not to dismiss that as a particular reality. That might be true, but it's also seeing the value in being still.
Yeah. Well, we just weren't built to live this way. I mean, we weren't built to constantly be filling our minds and our spirits with stimulation. This is not, like, our brains weren't meant to do this, you know?
Yeah, you talk about that at the beginning, like how it is actually affecting our brains in ways that even like the people who spend their whole lives researching this, like we're still in the early stages. Like, we don't really know how
our
brains are being reshaped.
Yeah.
We should care about that a little bit.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, and so, I mean, I think it is hard to experiment and to be intentional, you know, about these things. So this is where I think the collective, the idea of moving away from an individualized imagination to remembering that we are relational and that we do live within community and that things get done within community in ways that are much more transformational than even the individual, right? Mm-hmm. Where if we're going to start experimenting, hey, can we find a friend, right, who is feeling the same way, where we can say like, hey, you know, maybe you've had that conversation with that person before where you're like, this life is insane. Like, we're all just feeling so crazy, right? Mm-hmm. We get with that friend and we're just like, hey, how about let's do this? You know, like, let's just try this experiment together and see how it goes. And it might even be like, hey, you know, instead of texting each other, let's just try just for this couple days. What would it be like if we actually dialed the phone and, right, like clicked, like we're just going to actually hear each other's voices, you know, just for, let's just see what happens. You know, we're not committing to some long term 30-day plan. We're not, you know, let's just see what happens. And for me, the experiment model is attractive because I kind of buy the idea that as human beings, we are creatures of appetite. And when we taste something that is genuinely good, actually, right, that is deeply satisfying, not merely alluring, but it is actually satisfying, that we will want to come again, right?
Yes.
We will want more. And that will take intention.
We don't have to trick ourselves into it.
Yeah, it will take intention, and it will help to have friends come along that are doing it too. But when we taste enough of what is genuinely satisfying, of genuine communion, genuine rest, then we will start to know how to build our lives, right? Given what they are, to be like, okay, well, now I'm going to start building this deeper habit, you know? It's not just the 5 minute or the 15 minute occasionally, but like, hey, you know, like what? So one example for me during the pandemic, like before the pandemic, I couldn't keep a plant alive in my house. Like everything died. Okay. I was always like, I am the black thumb. Like, do not bring a plant close to me because I'm going to kill it. But what I realized during the pandemic was when all the kids were in the house, we're all working in the house, I was going crazy, you know, because I was just like, I can't, I'm a pretty like introverted solitude type of person. And so I realized I needed to get out of the house, and I started gardening, and it was really cool because there was a group of people that were gardening at the college. The college had a plot that needed tending. And so I started gardening, and I realized how satisfying it was, you know, just to get my hands in the soil, to be grounded in something that wasn't the screen. And once it was satisfying, I was like, all right, I'm committing to this. Like, this is good. Like, this is good stuff. I want to keep doing this. And so I was like, all right, give me a row. I'm committing to it. I'm going to, you know, tend to it. I'm going to weed. I'm all in. But that was just because in the beginning, I just started experimenting with it. I was like, all right, I'll go with my friends and see if I want to garden. I don't know. You know, I don't know anything about gardening. But it was just so deeply satisfying. And so I just think it's like that for all of us, you know, whatever it might be.
And I think the way you put it together as an experiment really puts it rather than a 30-day plan or whatever, because if it's a plan or if it's a regimen, then it allows us to measure it with success or failure.
Yes.
We either did it well and we succeeded, or we didn't do it well and we failed. And then, you know, all the guilt and the shame comes with that. But it's just like, hey, try it out. And there's there's no metric. Either it worked for you or it didn't. And that's not success or failure. You just tried. And I think that can be incredibly liberating for a lot of people, because I think, you know, in our jobs, in almost everything we do, we are measuring things by whether we succeeded or whether we failed at it. And, you know, there might be some environments where that's okay. If done well, can be healthy. But in ways of kind of shaping ourselves to grow more as individuals who are thoughtful, who contemplate, who are, like you said, centered. I think that really gives some freedom to a lot of people to say, hey, you're not being held to an obligation. Just ask you to try. And and if you're good with the trying, and it, like you said, it's satisfying, keep doing it. And if not, then you try something else and see if that works. And I think that that definitely is a very liberating point for a lot of people.
Yeah, I love how much hope is there. Like, I was going to ask you at the end, like, what kind of encouragement might you have for a listener who feels like stuck or isolated now with the pandemic? And I mean, just try something with grace for yourself. Is I mean, do you have anything beyond that?
Yeah, but I
mean,
I love how much hope for our there is. For our listeners.
Yeah. Other than call, we're going to put that in the show notes. And listeners, email us or give us a voicemail of how that goes when you actually call people.
It is the year of the voicemail, so this is perfect.
Yeah, you know, I think there are these small experiments, like, you know, if you're someone that goes to bed with the phone next to you or even under your pillow, what would it be like to put it on the other side of the room or even in a different room? Like, just to find out, you know, when you wake up and when you go to bed, like, if that changes your sleep, you know, I have my students do this and a lot of them are like, whoa, like, this was really different. Right. And then we have conversations about getting an analog alarm clock. But I think, you know, again, this is the sort of like encouraging ourselves to recognize our bodily, like our embodied selves, right? And you talked about place earlier, right? That space and place actually do matter. You know, like my family, our phones are on the opposite side of the house when we charge them up at night, because that actually gives me a lot of freedom when I'm going to bed. I'm kind of like, well, the phone's over there. Like, I don't know what's going to happen if it rings, like, you know, whatever. It's over there. I'm not going to keep checking it. I tend to think about sacred spaces and sacred places. Sacred times and sacred places. So I think about how, you know, for some of us, we're morning people. And so if you're a morning person, then block, you know, protect that first 10 minutes when you wake up in the morning, right? Protect it with smelling the coffee, looking outside, maybe walking outside if you're someplace where it's warm enough to walk outside.
Or cold enough.
Or actually, you know, looking at your kids, you know, like actually looking at them, right? Or if you're a night person, right, turning off the phone and just being like, the last 15 minutes of my wakefulness, I'm just not going to be on my phone. I'm going to read something. I'm going to play music. You know, I'm going to journal, whatever it is. I think there are these small things that we can do to create sacred places and sacred times that we can start to treasure. You know, like when you start doing the experiment enough, then you actually start being protective about that time or that place, which I think can be really cool.
Yeah. And I think I want to encourage people as well, because I've tried this and you can tell the addiction's there, because as soon as I set the phone down to pick the book up, my brain is saying, pick your phone up.
Go get it. Go get it.
There's a notification. I hear the zzz, zzz, and I'm like, oh, I gotta pick it up. And so I can't, it's almost sometimes where I can't even focus for 5 minutes. So it's an encouragement to say, it's going to be tough. It is going to be tough, because we have curated our entire lives and existence around technology. And so to do something, which I think it's fair to say countercultural, it's going to be tough. But again, there is another side where it's valuable. So go through that toughness in order to get the value of satisfaction on the other side. So I just wanted to qualify that, because it's, you know, people can hear this and be like, oh, okay, I can put my phone down for 5 minutes or 10 minutes and go ahead and read a book or something like that. Like you said, smell the coffee, look at the kids. But then you start doing that and you feel that aching, that itching, like,
oh yeah,
I don't have my phone on me. Like, I think I'm naked or something. You know what I mean? Because it's just like, I'm so tethered to it. Yeah. So there will be a challenge, but I think there still is value. And so if a person knows there is value on the other side, you just kind of have to labor to get that satisfaction, then that prompts them well to know that it's not just a flip of the switch and you'll have this idea, do the experiment, and it'll just take. But it's going to take a bit of work, and that's okay. That's expected, but keep pushing.
I always get tripped out whenever I do that, and like, you know, it's kind of like an addictive problem when you get those like phantom notifications, like my phone's not in my pocket, but like I feel a buzz because I want to feel a buzz. That's when it's crazy. I was gonna say, I was kind of like half-heartedly trying to do that at meal times, but in the last week or so, listening to the book, I have been more purposeful, like sometimes like turning them off, but sometimes like just getting them away from the table. And it's, I definitely have noticed more like the place, like feeling more like in that place and in that space. And it's simple, but like that is supposed to be a sacred time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think like if anyone out there has been an athlete, if you've been a musician, if you've ever trained or just honed a skill, mm-hmm. it's the same process, right? Mm-hmm. Like being an athlete, training for something, being a musician, an artist, you get through the hard, there's hard stuff you got to get through, right? To be able to actually feel the liberation, right? Of mm-hmm. being able to run fast or jump far or play music, you know, improv, right? Like you've got to train on those things. And I think in many ways, you know, Vince, you talked about how we've curated our lives in a certain way. It's like we have been trained already by our devices. We have to untrain, right? We have to train towards a different way, because we are living an extracted life, as Trevor put it, and that's just not sustainable.
Yeah, and honestly, it's not I think we think it's foreign sometimes, but it's actually pretty common, the practice itself, because it's like even when you start a job, you probably suck at that job for a while. And then you learn how to do that job well. And then once you do the job well, you skate through it like it's second nature. And so it's almost approaching it in that same way. You're probably going to stumble. You're probably going to fall a little bit. But in the same way that you know I have to get better at my job in order to keep it, I have to get better at this in order to keep my sanity. And so I think that's a huge encouragement. And I think it's not as foreign as people think. Yeah. It's just putting your mind in the right framework. So that's super encouraging.
Wow. What an honor to have you on, Felicia. This has been just a really enjoyable conversation. I think our listeners are going to have some great, great value in here, and maybe they'll, pause the podcast for a little bit and then just enjoy, you know, 15 minutes of nature or thought or whatever else. I used to listen to this podcast that would put like a 30 to 60 seconds of silence at the end of the podcast, which I also found to be one of my favorite parts of the podcast. It's just like reflecting over everything I just listened to and like processing it. Yeah. So,
but come back for the shout outs after you pause it for the.
We do this segment on our show. It's our only segment we really do, called Substantive Shout Outs. And the idea of Substance Shout Outs is just anything that you've been enjoying, whether it's in media of any kind, books, music, but it could be anything. It could be a show you've watched or, something, a thing that you went to, anything like that. So what's something that you've been enjoying lately that you'd like to shout out?
I listen to podcasts pretty regularly, and one that's been especially kind of meaningful recently is I listened to On Being by Krista Tippett, and she's recently been doing a couple actually replaying some older interviews that she had done with people that have recently passed away, Desmond Tutu, Thich Nhat Hanh. And it's just listening to these interviews with these two gentlemen has just been, just really meaningful. Mm-hmm. I also just recently, you know, I listened to Pass the Mic with Jamar Tisby on and off. And and I just recently listened to Jamar Tisby's episode on When God Seems Distant, where he talks about his own spiritual life recently. Mm. And I just found that to be such a blessing, such a gift to hear someone be super honest about how challenging it is to be a person of faith right now when you're seeing what's going on in the world and have a lot of questions about what's going on in the church. I was just really, really blessed by, I don't know, I just found it freeing, actually, to hear him articulate a lot of things that I've been feeling myself. So yeah, those are the two that come to mind. I'm someone who, you know, so I don't have my phone by my bed. And so I read children's literature when I go to bed. That's the sign of light stuff. So I've been plowing through the Enola Holmes series, which is kind of fun stuff. So I'll give that a shout out just because it's fun stuff.
Awesome.
Love that.
Where can people find you online so they can be following you and as well as engaging with the content you have?
Yeah, so I have a personal website. It's called FeliciaWuSong.com. And there you have kind of all the things I've been doing and writing on. If you want to find me through Westmont College, because I teach there, that's another way to find me and get in touch with me.
Awesome.
Excellent. Well, once again, Felicia, we really appreciate you coming on the podcast, thinking through these issues with us. And it's been a ministry to us, I know, and I know it's a ministry to our listeners as well. So we appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's been really fun to be with you all.
That was really encouraging. Thanks for your time, Felicia.
Well, have a great evening.
So that was our conversation with Dr. Felicia Wusong. That was like, man, that was really in the heyday. That was before we had to transition to the biweekly structure. That was, I think we did that close to 100. But yeah, during the COVID and immediate post-COVID time, that was such a wonderful time of so much engagement. That was really great. So thank you for joining along with us. We appreciate it. Anybody who shares this episode, if while you were listening to the episode, you found yourself agreeing or wanting to talk about this with friends, feel free to text this, message this to friends, share it on social media, help others find the show. And I don't have anything official to announce yet, but I will say that substance-related announcements, I've got a number of very interesting, high-quality guests on the schedule. I just need to get them scheduled and recorded. Don't want to make any official announcements until that's done, but got a couple of very exciting new guests to the show and a couple of high quality returning guests that I should be recording with shortly. So a few more weeks of some of our best re-releases, and then hopefully we'll get back to some great content. And we look forward to putting out some new content here before too long. And if you want to be a part of that, listener, you can join us monthly over at Patreon at patreon.com/thesubstancepod. For as little as $3 a month, you can sign up, join the team. Work as we are retooling everything. We're going to be working on maybe some community building things. Feel free to DM us on Instagram or shoot us an email at thesubstancepod@gmail.com if you have any suggestions. And for those of you who are really interested in hearing some announcements, I will say that by the time this comes out, probably in the next few days after this episode releases, I will have guested on a film podcast with some internet buddies over in the UK. And towards the end of that episode, I kind of gave them a little bit of an exclusive. They asked, and I was like, well, I'm feeling generous. Here's kind of some stuff I'm thinking. So if you want to check that out, that's over on The Stacks. I know there's several different podcasts called The Stacks, but if you check out my social media, I'll be sure to share that up, talk a little bit about some plans I have for the future, but many exciting things coming up, and we'd love for you to be a part of it. And beyond Patreon, if you just want to help us out here and there, or if you want to help us send a little just thank you package to Editor Dave, you can hit us up on Cash App at $thesubstancepod. If that is beyond just regular support for the show and you particularly want that to go to our gift to Editor Dave, make sure to leave us a note when you hit us on Cash App with that. And as we should always say, thank you to Trevor and Vince for our theme music, and thank you to my lovely wife, Anna, for our social media graphics. I've been your host, Philip Marinello, and we will see you next time on The Substance.